Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Turn to Daniel 5, please. Daniel 5, you probably know better, is Belshazzar's feast. And there's some very interesting things, this particular chapter 9. If you don't have an outline, would you raise your hand so we can get you one? Because you're going to need one. Need several in the back, please, Vernon. Raise your hand just for a little bit longer. And okay. Now, the discussion questions are, I think, particularly significant in this particular chapter because we have to deal with some things that we're not real sure of. And number one, who is Belshazzar? You say, well, obviously he's the king of Babylon. It says so right there, Belshazzar the king. Well, there is a historical problem here that has, I don't know if, maybe you have a commentary on Daniel from someplace. If you've been looking at the book of Daniel in any kind of set of commentaries, you'll know that there's a great problem with this man Belshazzar, because he is pictured as the last king before Cyrus takes over the empire. And as far as the chronicles of Nabonidus chronicles, the different cuneiform tablets that we found, Nabonidus was the last king. Now, many people before the age of archaeology had really gotten the full swing, had tried to identify Belshazzar with evil Merodach, which was the king before him, and on and on. And it really gets to be a big hassle. But just to say to you that last century, the critical scholars really took Daniel to task over three things in this chapter. Number one, the fact of that Belshazzar was unhistorical. The fact that Darius the Mede was unhistorical. The fact that Belshazzar can't be Nebuchadnezzar's son is unhistorical. Now, I usually don't drag you through critical problems, but I think I will tonight a bit in the fact of Belshazzar. We have found his name now on many cuneiform tablets, especially since about the 1940s. And he is never called the king of Babylon, but he is always called the son of the king. Now, Nabonidus was his daddy, and Nabonidus went bananas on one of the gods of Babylon. The chief deity of Babylon was Marduk, or Baal. Matter of fact, Belshazzar means Baal will guard, or Baal will protect. Now, because he left these two main deities and went to worship the moon goddess Sin, he built a special temple for Sin in Haran, and he went to live in a desert oasis called Pima in Arabia. And he stayed there for years and years, and we have found out archaeologically that he didn't give the title king to his son, but he gave all the authority for managing the state to his son, guess who? Belshazzar. And his name has appeared over and over and over again. And all the liberals can say is, well. And again, you see it says Belshazzar the king. Now, he's never called a king. And this may be an overstatement looking from a Babylonian point of view. But guess what? Daniel's not a Babylonian book, is it? The Jewish book, written for Jewish people. And therefore, as they understood, Belshazzar had the reins of government. He was the one that was on the throne in the capital city. He just calls him the king. And I see no problem with that in particular. Now, you see where it says, held a great feast? Remember the Septuagint. Now, if you're reading a commentary and you ever see the Roman numerals LXX, that stands for 70. And 70 in Greek is Septuagint, which we get the name for the Greek translation of the Old Testament, supposedly done by 70 Jewish scholars in 70 days for the library at Alexandria. Now, in this commentary, it was done about 2 or 3 B.C., something like that, a very old translation of the Old Testament. It says that this feast was at the dedication of Belshazzar's palace. Now, I don't know if that's true, and probably that's not accurate, because we don't know exactly how much time is between chapter 4 and chapter 5. Some very good Old Testament men want to say 70 years. I don't think it's quite that long, but how long it is, we do not know. Because There are several kings in between Nebuchadnezzar and Nabonidus and then Belshazzar. So we'll get to that in just a second. Now, you see what it said for a feast for 1,000 of his nobles or his government officials? You say, boy, he couldn't have that many at party. Did you know Alexander the Great one time had a 10,000 people at a party, a wedding party he threw? You talk about problems cutting the cake. 10,000 people. Woo! Man, well, he did. It's historical. Now, you notice where it says, when Belshazzar tasted the wine. Now, we've got to remember here that it doesn't mean, and when I hear that in English, Belshazzar tasted the wine, I just picture him taking a little sip and then running off to the temple and getting the things of God. But the Aramaic here means that when he become inebriated, he sent all. I mean, he was cropped. And that's exactly why he did this ridiculous thing, because these Babylonian kings had great respect for all the deities that they, of the people they... Matter of fact, they brought all the deities, a symbol of that deity, into their own temple. That's where they were keeping the things from God's house in Jerusalem, was in the temple of Merodach. Now, exactly why he did this, we don't know. A question a little bit later, we'll have to deal with this, exactly why he did it. There's several reasons. Number one, in verse 22, it says that he remembered all about what God had done to Nebuchadnezzar, but he didn't regard it, so he may have been doing it as spite to try to say that I think that deity did that to my great-granddaddy, but I'm going to do this to that deity. It may have been that he brought all the utensils from all the gods into there. Now, he's got 1,000 nobles, and I don't know how fast those boys drank, but for every one of those nobles and concubines and wives to drink out of the gold cups from the temple at Jerusalem took a long time. So they may have brought all the drinking utensils out of the temple. Exactly why it says just Jehovah's here, we don't know, or Yahweh's. Now, anyway, he ordered to go get them, and the gold and the silver vessels. Now, what gold and silver vessels are these? What were these used for? The temple in Jerusalem, right. Apparently, these gold and silver cups were either had by the priest to wave the wave offering, the drink offering before the Lord, because you've got to have some kind of container to wave that stuff. They wouldn't put it in their hands. So maybe it was the golden cup they put the drink offering in to wave before the Lord. Maybe it was the cup that they used inside the tabernacle for the priest to eat. We don't know exactly, because gold and silver cups aren't mentioned in the Old Testament. It's part of the temple furniture. So we don't know exactly what they were. But anyway, notice it says that which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, verse 2. Now, it's just one problem. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't his father. Matter of fact, we can't find where Belshazzar was related to Nebuchadnezzar at all. Nebuchadnezzar had a son who succeeded him called Evil-Merodach. Evil-Merodach was killed by a conspiracy by another man who became king. And that son-in-law, his son-in-law became king. And on down it went. And finally, Nabonidus was a brother-in-law to Nebuchadnezzar, not related. Now, either he'd adopted Belshazzar, who was of the royal line, or it's simply a way of saying that all the Babylonian kings were related. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is not his daddy. How many of you have a Bible that tries to relate the age of the Old Testament, tries to go back and say when the earth was created, when Noah was, and all that? Well, it's following a man called Usher. And it says that it makes 4004 the date creation and all. Now, the problem with that is the lineages in the Old Testament don't follow consecutively. Many times, this word father, in Hebrew and Aramaic, there is no term for grandfather or grandson. Do you know that? There is no word in the Hebrew language or Aramaic language for grandfather or grandson. Usually, it's the father's father or something like that. Now, many of these genealogies in the Old Testament would list a great man in the lineage and say he was so-and-so's father, when we can prove all over the place that he wasn't. One example that comes to mind is Jehu destroyed the dynasty of Omri, but he is called the son of Omri. Now, he wasn't even related to Omri, you see? So the Bible uses the word father many times as ancestor, and that's exactly what it is here. Now, you see where it says his wives and concubines might drink from them? Now, in Persia, it was very unusual for the women to be a part of the men's drinking. Remember how the trouble Esther got into when she went there? Remember the king had to call for Vashti, his first wife? Well, the Persians didn't do it, the Medes didn't do it, but the Babylonians did it. And so it's very common. This shows the historicity of the book of Daniel. It wasn't written by somebody 165 B.C. because this is 6th century B.C. It's just the social milieu of the day was this kind of thing, and that's what we have here. Now, you see where it talks the temple of God. This is, of course, the temple, Yahweh's temple. This is the one built by Solomon and all the rest they're talking about in verse 3. Now, you see where it talks that about the lampstand in verse 5? This is not the word for the menorah. Now, the menorah is the seven candlestands of the Jews. You see it all the time as a symbol of Judaism. This is not referring to that. This is referring to the candelabras that lit up the halls of these kings, and they had to have many of those things around the halls at night. Now, you see where it says in verse 5, the plaster of the wall? We've excavated Babylon about, I don't know how long ago it was finished, but I know it wasn't too many years ago, and they have found this plaster, white, smooth plaster, put over the rough wall finish in those, and inside the palaces there in Babylon. And it's the exact kind of thing it's talking about here. So any kind of dark writing would appear. It was like these walls looked here. Now, these isn't white. This is kind of an off yellow. But anyway, it looked smooth like that. And we have found the very king's chamber in one of the temples in Babylon that's been excavated. And so this just fits right in with the day. Now, you see down in verse 6 where it talks about the king got nervous. I like listen to verse 6. His face grew pale, his thoughts alarmed him, his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. Think the old boy was shook? Boy, he got upset. Well, you can imagine, you know, it'd be kind of like me preaching and all of a sudden a hand come and put amen on the wall. No. But you can imagine what would happen if... Well, you are slow, aren't you? I can't say it. Anyway, that even upset me. It'd be like, you can imagine how upset you would get in something like that. So he was upset. Boy, he called for the wise men, the Chaldees, and everybody else, and they couldn't read it. Read what it said. So he said, "Boy, I'll give you a purple robe, and I'll give you a gold necklace if you can read this thing." Now, King James has the word scarlet, but it's not scarlet, it's purple. And purple is a symbol of royalty. It was always a symbol of royalty in the Middle East. Now, Lydia was not royalty, but by that time, it became to mean something else. Now, the gold necklace is the same kind of thing. It's used as a symbol of a king. It's an authority kind of figure. That's what Pharaoh gave Joseph, remember? Put a gold necklace around his neck. It's used all through the Bible as that kind of way, a symbol of authority. Now, you see what it says? And I'll make him oath. Now, what does your translation have in verse 7? Mine has, and have authority as a third ruler in the kingdom. Now, what does yours have? Become the third ruler? What is that translation? Living Bible. Okay, somebody else. Shall be the third ruler? Okay, what else? Anybody else? It's a very difficult word. Boy, I don't really know how to translate it. It's talking about the number three or a third or something. I think it fits very well with the historical setting of who's number one? Nabonidus. Who's number two? Belshazzar. Who's number three? Well, it'd be the guy who interpreted that handwriting on the wall. So the number third part of the third ruler fits very well in the historical context of Nabonidus being king and Belshazzar being co-regent. Now, you see where it says they could not read the inscription. Now, I was going to bring something, but I forgot it. Why couldn't they read it? It was Hebrew. Why couldn't they read it? Well, there's been several suggestions, I think all of which are very good. Number one, we're not talking about vowels, we're just talking about consonants, okay? They didn't have vowels. Aramaic, Hebrew, no vowels this time, just consonants. So, it may have been that instead of writing horizontally, the writing was in vertical. Instead of being horizontal, it was vertical, yeah. They're used to reading from left to right like we are, but Hebrew reads which way? From right to left. So you can imagine the problem it would be if these words, just the consonants were mentioned, like M, N, and then the next one, C, in a row like that, and backwards. Another thing is possible, these words have been interpreted, that these words can be interpreted, I don't want to say they really mean this because I'm not sure, but the consonants can also stand for particular weights of measure, something like a penny and a nickel and a dollar, something like that. Well, you can imagine if you just saw that in the wall, what does that mean, a penny, a nickel, and a dollar? Well, you wouldn't understand what it means either. So anyway, they couldn't read this inscription, and therefore King Belshazzar gets real upset. His knees are still knocking. Of course, that hurts. And so the Septuagint again, between verses 9 and 10, adds another verse. And the verse the Septuagint adds says, the king became so distraught that he sent for the queen. Well, you see in verse 10, the queen comes in. Now, who is the queen? You say, obviously, it's his wife. Can't be his wife. His wife and his concubines are all mentioned up here in verse 2. Now, who is the queen? Well, nobody knows, but here's some possibilities. It may have been Nabonidus' wife. It may have been the wife of Nebuchadnezzar, who was very old, the queen mother. We don't know who the queen was, but it probably wasn't his wife. Now, she walks in, and hadn't been to the party at all, and she walks in and talks to him about Daniel, a man who has wisdom and knowledge and the spirit of the holy gods. Notice that. She's not a Christian, you know. She's not a Christian. She's not a believer. She's still a polytheist. The holy gods is in him, and on we go about that. And then notice, by the way, I have a couple of reasons why I think that this lady was not his wife. And let me give these to you real quick. I forgot about it. Number one, the wives are mentioned in verse 2. Number 2, she knew Daniel. Number 3, she came in without being invited. It's very uncommon for a woman to do that in that day. So those are three reasons why I don't think it's his wife. Now, if you come over to verse 12, whose name is found there? I've been pronouncing Daniel's name as Belshazzar, but I've been pronouncing it wrong. I never did see the E in there until I saw Belshazzar's feast. And Daniel's name should better be pronounced Belteshazzar. There's a T-E in there, long E. But if you have King James, it's not that at all. It's called Balthazar, isn't it? Instead of Belshazzar for the feast. This name has been misspelled and respelled, and there are about 15 ways to spell this name. It depends if you look at the Peshitta, or if you look at the Vulgate, or if you look at the Greek Septuagint, you look at the Masoretic text, there's all kinds of ways to spell this name. I think that the name of the king and the name of Daniel are the same name, but every English translation that I found, I looked at RSV, I looked at mine, I looked at Amplified, looked at King James, they spelled Daniel and the king's name different, have the T-E in there. But I think it's the same name, and it's probably very close. The spelling is what goofed us up. Now, I'm going to skip the majority of just the text, because it's very simple here about what's happening. He explains this. Beginning in verse 17, Daniel says, "Don't you remember about your daddy?" He calls him a father. Nebuchadnezzar and all the grandeur he had. Now, in verse 20, the words heart and spirit are synonymous. I think that's important. It's not that man has a spirit and has a body, but right here is a good example of Hebrew parallelism, and here would be Aramaic parallelism, but anyway, heart and spirit are synonymous there. And then he goes on to tell you about how he went crazy and went out and ate with all the animals. And then verse 22 is very important to me. It says, "Yet you," and that's an emphatic position in the Hebrew, in Aramaic I mean, "you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this." Now, here is the reason that God judged this king. He wasn't any worse than any other Oriental monarch. But he was a proud stinker. He was arrogant. He knew all this, what God had done, and he still went in there and got those things from God's temple and was just blaspheming far above any other kind of Oriental monarch. Now, I told you that all these monarchs had a reverence for all these different people's gods. They would not talk against them. They were kind of like the Baha'i of our day. You know, if you like this fella, just bring him on in. So that verse 22 is very important. Now notice verse 23, it says, talks about the idolatry, that you have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And put CF, please, Deuteronomy 4:28, which talks about the idolatry and all these different kinds. Some commentators say that because there are six things mentioned, the number six is the number of imperfection, the number of the world, and all that, and that it's symbolic there. I don't know if that's true. I can't think of anything else that those idols could have been made out of. They listed everything, it seems like. So I'm not sure that it's symbolic there of a certain number. Now, in verse 25, we get what was on the wall. Now, it's many, many, tico, eupharsin. Now, let's go and see what it means. Many and tico and eupharsin are all passive participles. That means that somebody else is acting upon the verb, okay? Now, many, just the infinitive form means to number. And then the tekel form, the way you spell it in Hebrew, would be S-H-A-Q-A-L. And it means to weigh. And then the last one, you in Aramaic, is the little, it's a little thing that you put before a word to say and. So the word there is the word perish, and it means to divide or to break. Now, Daniel read these things, but it wasn't so much that he read them that was important, but he interpreted them. And what it means, he said, you see in verse 27, 28, and 29, you've been weighed, well, I guess back to 26, you've been numbered, the king you put to an end. This word numbered, not only meant numbering like number a bunch of apples, but it meant numbered like the boundary set on a man's life. Your days, well, we have a little phrase in English, your days are numbered. Well, that fits right, this Aramaic word meant. And then the word tekel means you've been weighed. It's a thing that comes from the merchandise business. And they would put a little weight on here and give you so much grain. And what it's saying is you've been weighed morally, and you've been found very deficient. And then it talks about the next one, the word perish. And it just means your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. Now, many folks say that the consonants in this last word in 28 are the same as the consonants in the word Persians, and that's how Daniel knew the Persians were going to do it. If this is a supernatural revelation, why couldn't God have just told him the Persians were going to do it? I don't really see any connection there. Well, that to me is pulling at straws and trying to explain how he knew. Notice here that the Medes and the Persians, notice the order. Medes listed first, Persians listed second. Another reason why this book cannot have been written during the Maccabean period, 165 B.C., it had to be written in the 6th century, is that after Cyrus, it never was the Medes and the Persians anymore. It was always, guess what? The Persians and the Medes. Now, Cyrus is, you know, very, very late here in the sense of being way back in the 6th century. So, this another proof to me that this book was written in Daniel's time and not in the Maccabean time. Now, you see verse 30 where it says, that same night Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. Now, for secular history says that the town had been under siege for quite a while, that it was under siege by Cyrus's forces. And remember the picture of Babylon I showed you? It had a river running right through the middle. And what river was that? The river Euphrates ran right through the city of Babylon. But the walls were so high that they said, well, we can hold out. We've got water, we've got food, we've got land to cultivate. They can't get in here. So Cyrus built a dam and diverted the water of the Euphrates around the city, and his men walked under the hole in the wall where the river had gone. And he was slain that night. We have many historians, both Greek and ancient, that say it happened without a fight. Babylon was taken. The priest afterwards opened the gates. And so now, many people say that between verse 30 and 31 is a long period of time. Now, really, 31 goes with chapter 6, and I'm not going to talk about this man tonight because, Darius is a whole problem in itself, and I'm going to wait till next week to cover it. But anyway, I think 31 should go with chapter 6. And I do think this happened the same night of Belshazzar's feast. I don't think it was a long period of time between. Can you believe that I am through with the fifth chapter of Daniel? And I have 12 minutes left. That means I can go over next week? I owe you something anyway, don't I? Yes. Be fifth. What verse in chapter 10? Oh, verse 10 of chapter 5. Oh. No, Daniel lived a long, long time. We don't know how long he lived. Yours has Queen Mother as a translation? That's a bit interpretive. See, he's telling you what this means and nobody knows. Living Bible? It's a bit interpretive. The word's just the queen. And then the father does mean ancestor, But exactly how many generations, we don't know, because it's all balled up in who was king and when. One king was an imbecile child and reigned less than a year. He was beat to death on the throne physically. So I don't know exactly if it's fifth or not, but it does mean ancestor. No. Some people say that fifth generation means that all the five kings from Nebuchadnezzar down were judged. Oh. No. Yeah, fifth king. It wouldn't be 100 years, because that one king was only on for 1 year, see. So. Any other questions? Yes, Claude. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. The only reason that'd be very good evidence if the Babylonians weren't so proud of writing everything that happened. Now, they probably didn't write about Daniel interpreting those dreams, because that would have been, well, it's just like saying somebody from Nicaragua came and saved our country. Well, you wouldn't, you know, we'd explain how he was trained in American schools and, you know. Well, see, they wouldn't write that either, so that's very good. Yeah, she had to have some kind of first-hand knowledge or the story passed down. It's really a problem who she is. Boy, she walks in, you can almost tell the scene changed. From a drunken orgy boy, they're awake when that hand walks on the wall, and then she walks right in and takes charge, kind of. Now, she says some nice things to the king, but it's just court language. You know, like when we're out in public, you don't call me, hey, fat boy, like you do when we're with each other, right? You call me Brother Utley. Well, that's the same thing here. She says, live forever, O king. But if she was with him, she'd have probably called him something else. So it's language of conversation there of the court. Don't you all call me that. Yes, Jack. Yeah. Right. It is. It's the word in 28. Yeah. See, the you is the word and the word farsen is the passive participle. So the word up here, perish, is the infinitive or the regular verb. So, right now, verb. Okay. Anybody else? And I'll take questions up to the fifth chapter in Daniel, because I know hopefully some of this stuff is beginning to accumulate with you. Let me offer a suggestion. If you can't spend the money to buy E.J. Young's commentary, it's about, what is that thing? It's about $5.95? Something? I found a commentary that I think is very good. Now, it's a commentary that most of the stuff that's in it is copied, in a sense, out of other commentaries, but it's cheap and it's good. It's done by one of the men who teach at Sunset Church of Christ. And you can buy it at Sentinel Bookstore. It's a little paperback about that thick for $2.50. And it's on Daniel, and it's very good. It goes by paragraph. And so buy that one.